By Claire Campbell-Smith. Here on Radio 4 FM, our new book of the week is the Indian journalist Anjan Sundaram's vivid account of self-discovery in Africa. Back in 2005, idealistic and aged just 22, he decided to give up his PhD in maths, which took him to war-torn Congo, where he spent a year half pursuing a new career. In today's episode, he is newly arrived and overwhelmed in Kinshasa. Stringer is read by Riz Ahmed.
I was already feeling perturbed. There was something perhaps about the bar's large parasol umbrellas, lit starkly by the hanging naked bulbs, or it could have been the figures flitting behind them, beyond my view. I had sensed his presence, his curt movements. They did not seem malicious. Then he lunged for my table, and I found myself running in the night. People passed me by like pages in a flipbook, mamas with bananas on their heads, vendors carting cages of birds and monkeys, the crocodile leather pointy-shoed bureaucrats. They turned to stare at me, the whites of their eyes stabbing the darkness and piercing my face, my side, my back. Who are you looking at? He's a thief. Stop him. We regressed from the city. The alleys amplified the darkness, grey walls high and long between which I ran blindly, without thinking, until we came to a field. And for a moment I lost sight of him. I turned sharply, feeling a panic rise. You! He appeared, empty-handed and jeering at me. A sickly chicken of a boy. You have my phone! I yelled. Tch! I refuse! The ground was wet and yielding, covered in waste. The smell was rotten. A landfill in the middle of the city. I'll give you money, I said. How much? He wiped his shoulder over his mouth. His face was covered in sweat. Keep the phone. I only need the numbers. He smiled, as if smelling a trick. I didn't have money to hand out, but those numbers were precious. I was new in the country and had few friends. Kinshasa, when I first arrived, had felt giant, overwhelming. The city appeared as a collusion of secrets only the locals shared. But the strangers I had met, journalists, businessmen, minor politicians whose numbers I kept, had become bearings from which I navigated the confusion. The boy was stepping away. I yelled, "How do I find you? What's your name?" "Guy." And making a cackling noise, he ran behind a mound. The main road was unlit and cars streamed past. I found space in a minibus, an old Volkswagen whose 12 cushioned seats had been pulled out and replaced with wooden benches. Soon we were more than 30 inside. Human smells engulfed us. At a roundabout, we circled a brick monument, black as though burned. The statue of the Belgian king had long been toppled, leaving two pillars framing an empty space. Lining the roads were heaps of garbage, glowing like embers and giving off black smoke. The collapse, the crisis. It is how the world knows Congo. Death is as widespread in few places. Children born here have the bleakest futures. The country heads nearly every conceivable blacklist. We came to the boulevard, the city's artery. Not far away was the Congo River, opening into a pool and curling around us. One is reminded that this place, even in Europe, was once called the Beautiful, La Belle. The minibus turned into the Avenue de Wilry and soon had to share space with the pedestrians. We shed the colonial structures. Buildings on the road grew small and clustered. Against this backdrop, the sluggish walkers appeared almost magical, like the survivors of a cataclysm. Men wore suits and fat knotted ties, yellow and pink. Women, frilly, fancy dresses. The shoes stepping in the mud were well polished, so laboriously beautiful. The people had an air of character, defiance. We at last arrived at the roar of Victoire, my neighborhood, and one could feel the chaos become acute. Where I alighted, a street of crooked wooden stalls lit by kerosene lamps winged insects gathering around their glows. My house in Bozene Avenue was a one-story structure with dirty white walls ringed by blue paint at the bottom. I stepped in. José and Nana sat at the table, napkins tucked in. The living room was long and divided into two areas. Close to the door was the dining table. At the far end was a television, surrounded by khaki sofas. I rented a room from José and Nana, themselves renters. José was a mild man who worked in the city tax department. Nana was a housewife, though she had a certificate as a nurse. She hurried off to find me a plate. The stew was in a large casserole, and a ceramic bowl contained white rice. The family ate only one meal a day. José called it lunch. Nana called it dinner. And it was custom to serve oneself all at once, without expecting the food to pass around again. I finished my plate, still hungry. I had left for Congo in a sort of rage, a searing emotion. The world had become too beautiful. The beauty was starting to cave in on itself, revealing a core of crisis. I was at the time at university in America. Professor Serge Lang, a legend of mathematical theory, sat behind his large desk. He believed in my mathematical ability and gave me more than $2,000 worth of his textbooks. I studied them, convinced that I was going to become a professor. But on this day, it was with those same books piled high in my arms that I stumbled into his office. Lang frowned. He had understood. "What happened?" he said. I felt as if I had betrayed him. In my field, algebra, we were devoted to a search for the universe's deeper rules. This new mathematics was pristine, but it offered no stimulus to the senses. I had started to feel lost. "Where will you go?" Lang asked. "Congo. I'm going to try to be a journalist." "To play the fool," he said it at once. His face was stern, but he was smiling with his eyes, brilliant. I broke with America. Congo consumed me. After Lang's calm world of mathematics, I felt here only impermanence, fear. I had to constantly push, fend. I felt somehow alert. Journalism seemed a natural choice. I felt that the profession would immerse me in the world and take me to the crisis. The world appeared to be uneasy about Congo, to turn away from it. I wanted to experience this place, to see how people responded to such crisis. In my favor was the moment. Congo's elections, due in less than a year, would be historic, the country's first chance in four decades at democracy. It gave me immediate purpose. I visited the election commission. The vision of Congo was different here, gleaming, organized, contemporary. I was given a front seat as a foreigner. My questions were answered graciously. Later, local journalists came up to tell me that the answers I had been given were wrong, and they proposed we collaborate. 2 days later, a knock sounded on our door, and Mossi, a journalist I had met at the election commission, strode in. "Why are you not picking up the phone?" he said. I told him my phone was stolen. "Ah, good," he said. "I thought you were avoiding me. The president is giving a meeting tomorrow." "I wasn't aware," I said. "Get your phone, man. Pay the boy off. $50 does the trick." I did not need more convincing, and at another time I might have shown more prudence. I asked around. The landfill was known as the 25th Quarter. It had once been a cemetery. The taxi deposited me at a stretch of sand and left at once. Two mounds of waste formed an entrance to the 25th Quarter. Instantly I felt apprehensive. In front, in the field, dozens of empty car frames were silhouetted against the sky, making shapes like large tombstones. The garbage rose as mounds and arches rolled over pipes and fell into pits. The boundary with the city was lost. The garbage seemed to grow in an expanse around me and consume the city as one gigantic slum. Cautiously, I circled the first mound. Behind it stood a boy in a pit of water. The pool was black, like some juice secreted from the surrounding decomposition. He froze when I said, "Guy? Guy, where's my phone?" "Phone?" He paused. "Gone." His French was labored. "I have money," I said. "Give me money." These words came easily. There was nothing to be done, and I let it go. And I think how I didn't get angry and accepted his word, surprised Guy. He held my arm and took me into the field. We came to a grey car frame. All the glass was gone and the chassis was dotted with barnacle-like clumps of orange rust. The ceiling was too low to stand under. We sat on the ground. On the dashboard were arranged liquor bottles. Guy handed me one, pulling out the stopper, while he upturned a nearly empty bottle over his mouth. The liquor smelled like laboratory alcohol. We went out again. "Come," said Guy, opening his arms as if showing me some monument. In his tone, I caught a sense of pride. For the first time, I saw graves. The city used to place its dead here, but garbage, it seemed, had simply been piled on top. As night fell, children materialized from the cars, like mice, carrying bottles and blowing puffs of smoke in thick, mysterious clouds. One saw us and cried, a big-boned but skinny boy. He skipped over, followed by a girl. The boy and Guy pushed each other. The girl came around, dirty but pretty, with brilliant eyes, large like leaves. She looked older than the boys. All of them seemed in their mid-teens. From his pocket, Guy drew out a joint that he lit and smoked with compressed lips. The girl put the joint in her nose and inhaled it to half the length. Her eyes had turned red. The boys fell upon her. She rolled, laughing, pulled away. I wasn't sure if I should be shocked. It seemed natural, innocent, merely play. At the time, what struck me was the freedom I felt around the children. Their lives were unbridled by the constraints and the repression of society. Yet almost every journalistic report, NGO statement, and academic paper I found perverted their lives, depicting everything as a wretchedness. It was important to me that the children be able to express themselves in terms near their own, and not be described by a moral or even sympathetic prejudice imposed on their experience. I would experience such incongruity repeatedly. In miserable places, I would find the most exuberant joie. It seemed to me both extraordinary and implausible, and at first I imagined it to be a cosmetic cover-up, a mask worn to hide the suffering or to help overcome it. That may have partly been true, but I also felt that the Congolese, in their delirium, truly forgot the misery. That they spoke in verse and caricatured their misfortune in genuine comic spirit and not for farce. It was their way of taking distance, I thought, of suspending the destruction of time. To a degree that exceeded any people I had known, I found the Congolese able to isolate the present and be satisfied. Theirs was a sort of amnesiac solace. The night had been a strange, frenzied experience, and all the following morning the nostalgia lingered, making the house seem dreamlike. That was my first adventure. Good morning, Kinshasa.
Riza Ahmed continues to read Stringer by Anjan Sundaram at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer, Elizabeth Allard.
I have a proposition for you.
Look, I'm really not...
It will change your life forever.
From the author of Slumdog Millionaire.
There are 7 traits that I'm looking for in our new CEO.
If an offer seems too good to be true, it probably is.
When you exhibit these traits, you pass.
A thriller based on Vikas Swarup's best-selling novel, The Accidental Apprentice.
In 4 months' time, I'll be facing a murder charge.
The 7th Test on BBC Radio 4, all this week at 10:45.